screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Hey everyone, welcome to a very special episode of
The Goods,
a film podcast. This is Dan and I've got Brian with me. How you doing, Brian?
Hey Dan, what makes this one special?
Well, you know, in some ways, every episode of The Goods is a special episode as far as I'm personally concerned. That's how I feel about our podcast. But I would say that this episode in particular is special because we are talking about a David Lynch movie. And not just any David Lynch movie, we're talking about Mulholland Drive, the 2001 opus, a strange film. Spoilers, and not a spoilers if you listen to the pod before, one that I like a lot. But let's talk about it, Brian. So, whew, Mulholland Drive, what were you expecting?
Well, yeah, I guess we'll talk a bit about our previous exposure to David Lynch. It's kind of a scenario where I don't know what I expected, in the words of Jason Bateman. But yeah, this is a weird one. Previously on the podcast, we've had a whole episode dedicated to The Elephant Man, which is more of a run-of-the-mill biopic. Occasionally, it lapses into the Lynchisms, but this is fully off the rails into the Lynchverse. This is like, it's a lot like Twin Peaks. And if you read up on it, it started as a spinoff of Twin Peaks.
I hadn't heard the spinoff of Twin Peaks. I had heard a TV show. I mean, maybe it was a spinoff.
Well, in the original version, they said it was going to focus on Audrey.
Oh, interesting.
One of the supporting characters from Twin Peaks, and then I think it kind of became its own thing as a television project, and then eventually did not get picked up as a TV series, and he turned it into a movie.
Yeah, when I watch Mulholland Drive, it reminds me of this YouTube video. There's this video that I know I've referenced on the pod before. It's called Streets 112, and it's this guy going on this super hype monologue after he breaks some GoldenEye speedrunning record, like the video game GoldenEye. And at one point during that, he shouts out of the blue, "Dude, what a rush!" And that's how I feel about watching Mulholland Drive. It's just a rush of 2.5 hours of strangeness. Segments of it are like hold together, and other segments, the segments don't all quite fit together. We'll get there. We'll talk about it.
Another quote from that Streets video that was brought up when we talked about it in the Odyssey review. He said, "I am a legend. I am a fucking legend."
Yes.
And maybe David Lynch thinks that about himself.
Certainly movie critics do. They voted David Lynch's Mulholland Drive the second best film of the 21st century to date, behind In the Mood for Love, which we also have talked about on this pod. And that was in the 2022 Sight and Sound BFI poll, Brian. So this is also one that's pretty critically well regarded.
So the Sight and Sound, that was just for 21st century?
No, that was for all films in history. But out of films from the 21st century that placed on this list, this placed second highest.
Okay. And where was it all time?
I think it was top 20 on that. I could be wrong. I think it was like 15 or something. Could look that up.
But for a little context, though, like number one on the Sight and Sound was what, John Delman at 415 on the Brux Del Rue or something. Some convoluted French title that nobody walking the streets of America knows what that is.
Yeah. It's a Belgian movie, not a French movie. A mistake that has often made. But yeah, I guess it's the French language. Yeah, so I've kind of skipped over an important part of our introduction because we are still in the midst of a theme month, Brian. And that is Movies About Making Movies Month. This is our eighth week, so it's clearly more than just a theme month at this point. But we've just been talking movies about making movies, meta, diving in deep. And I knew that the last film that I picked for this grand theme month was going to be a David Lynch movie. This is the ninth David Lynch movie out of 10 that he's made, excluding his TV shows. And the 10th is also a movie about making movies. That's called Inland Empire. That is by reputation even stranger and more obtuse than Mulholland Drive. So I'll save that one for a different episode, Brian.
What was the title of that one?
Inland Empire.
Okay.
And it stars Laura Dern. Before we dive into it, would you say that this is a movie about making movies, Brian?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. It takes place in Hollywood. Very much, I guess, Mulholland Drive is a real street up in the Hollywood Hills. And you've got a prominent character who's an actress and a prominent character who's a director. So I think it fits the bill.
Yep. Some crucial scenes take place in the movie-making world. And I would argue that thematically it's even more about making movies than it is textually about making movies. And we can maybe talk a little bit about that.
Thematically, I can't tell you what this movie's about. And we'll definitely talk a little more about that.
Last thing before we talk about the plot, and maybe we can put a pin in this one if we start to get too much into spoilers territory, but you said that this is fully into the Lynchverse. We're going full steam ahead, full tilt, David Lynch. When we say something is very Lynchian, something is a David Lynch film, what does that mean to you, Brian?
So another David Lynch movie that I've seen was, I think, his first feature, at least, was Eraserhead. Have you watched that one through?
No, I have not. That would be one I'd like to see sometime.
Okay. This made me think a lot of Twin Peaks, also made me think quite a bit of Eraserhead, because one of his traits, I feel like, is somebody will sit in a chair and then, like, have a seizure. They'll, like, be sitting at a breakfast table or something. They'll just start jerking around. Also, if you have somebody in, like, a room, a little room with a lot of curtains.
Oh, yeah.
And like, weird lighting in that room, that's also definitely David Lynch. What about you? What are the hallmarks?
Yeah, I think those are good, like, tics he has. It's kind of like when we're talking about Wes Anderson. He's got tics, but he's also got, like, an overarching style. And for David Lynch, for me, the overarching style is very dreamlike. Very, I don't know what the right word is, uncanny. There is something that's like just outside the tips of normal reality, like outside the boundaries of what feels right. It usually kind of has this sheen. And here I'm really thinking about Twin Peaks and Mulholland Drive. And I know Blue Velvet is a little bit like this. And you got a little bit of this in Elephant Man, but you kind of have this kind of proper world that's clean and classic. For many of them, it's kind of like a sort of mid-century kind of almost Edward Scissorhands type suburbia. But there's just something kind of off about it, and it's very toxic. And it kind of has this implication that, like, the things that are prettiest on the surface are at their core the most dangerous and vile. And you get lots of, like, weird things that are maybe not scary in isolation, but, like, in context are just kind of off-putting and, like, just put you on edge. Like, you're looking at something almost human, but not quite human.
Yes. Another thing is there's often this, like, droning soundtrack, and it's just kind of underneath everything and, like, putting pressure on your eardrums more than it's necessarily music. Like, even when nothing menacing is happening visually, there's just this note going on. And it's like, this is weird. Something is bad. Something's gonna happen, even if it hasn't happened yet.
Lynch's go-to composer, Angelo Badalamenti. I don't know quite how you pronounce his name. Outstanding composer. One of the greats, as far as I'm concerned. His Laura Palmer theme for Twin Peaks is one of the greatest pieces ever composed for screen. And I think his score here is also terrific. It very much puts you on edge with like kind of a droning quality, but also kind of an underlying beauty. It's like swelling strings with synths in there too. It feels slightly off and like it kind of fills the air sort of, but yeah, great, great score. Yeah. You're just kind of always on edge. So let's talk through Mulholland Drive, Brian. So the film opens with kind of a strange series of images, sort of this impressionistic shot of people dancing a jitterbug. And then we kind of see blurred into it the lead actress of the film, that is Naomi Watts, smiling kind of in the center of the frame. And then we cut to a handheld shot of a bed. Here we get something curtainy and billowy like you were talking about, but in this case, it's a bed with sheets. The handheld shot kind of takes us to this red pillow.
I want to talk for just a second about this dance that starts out the movie, because it uses like reverse green screen, which is a crazy effect that I am a big fan of, which is you kind of have to see it. I first saw it in this weird clip from like the 80s of people in cat suits doing cat ballet. But what it is instead of a person with the background like cookie cutter cut around them and replaced with something else, the silhouette of the person is the cutout. So it's like if you've seen the Pixar short Night and Day, it's like a moving human silhouette that makes the mat that you're looking through. And I really like that effect. It's weird.
Completely agree. To me, it's very jarring, and we're kind of right in that uncanny territory that we're talking about. We also see at the dance this old couple who appears about five times throughout the film, and every one of them is weirder than the last appearance.
It's never normal. The old people are never normal.
But they're just like generic looking old people, and they just have these big creepy smiles on their face. Yeah. So anyways, after that opening with the dance and the shot of the bed, we cut to a limo driving at night on Mulholland Drive in Hollywood. And we see there's this woman whose name is the subject of much intrigue throughout the film. She's played by an actress named Laura Herring or Haring. I'm not familiar with her in other stuff, but I think she's pretty good in this. And she's got dark hair. And as this limo is kind of driving down the Mulholland Drive, we see that there are these two other men, and one of them has a gun, and the limousine stops and they tell her to get out of the car. And it's pretty clear they're going to kill her with the pistol with the silencer that they have, when this group of joyriding teens just screaming down the road crashes into the limo, and all the cars go flipping. Everybody in the cars die except the woman, who, because she had stepped out of the car, she just gets injured. She gets a bonk on the head and she's concussed. And we will learn she has lost her memories of what happened prior to that car crash. And she kind of wanders down the hills of Hollywood. We get some shots from Mulholland Drive, looking out at Hollywood, looking sort of ghostly and strange with these kind of glowing lights. It made me think of La La Land, which has some shots of the looking out on Hollywood from up in the hills. And she kind of wanders down the hills and into this glitzy apartment on Sunset Boulevard. So we see another street, Sunset Boulevard, where she kind of walks into this apartment and she collapses onto a bed.
Sunset Boulevard, another good movie about making movies.
There you go. That's one I thought about picking, but we didn't. Maybe if we had gone to 13 weeks instead of 9, that would have made the cut. So then we meet our second main character, and this is Naomi Watts again. Her name is Betty, and she flies into Hollywood. She is hoping to make it big as an actress. And this is like straight out of A Star Is Born. A young girl with big dreams pulling into Hollywood, hoping to get her big break. Or at least the 30s, A Star Is Born, I was thinking of, Brian.
Mm-hmm. What was her name in that? I guess it was Esther, right? in those first few.
Yeah, didn't she have like a frumpy name? What was it?
Yeah, Esther Blodgett in at least the first two.
But here it's Betty. And we see that Betty is staying in her aunt's apartment. And wouldn't you know, it's the same apartment that Laura Herring has stumbled into. And so she sees her in there and at first assumes that she's another guest, but they gradually talk. And Betty learns that this woman is an unexpected interloper here. The woman sees a poster on the wall of a Rita Hayworth movie and decides to adopt the name Rita. So henceforth, she is Rita. So we have Betty and Rita as kind of the two characters here. And they get to talking and they decide they're going to figure out her identity. So the only thing that she knows about herself is that she has this bag, and inside the bag is a massive amount of money, like probably hundreds of thousands of dollars in $100 bills, and this blue key. So that kind of sets off one plot thread here. And meanwhile, there's a couple other plot threads going on. So I want to talk about those other plot threads. But before we do, Brian, where's your headspace at right now as we're following Rita and Betty around Hollywood trying to figure out what Rita's true identity is?
So the first third of this movie, I didn't know what was going on. And then the second third of the movie, we're following the director character more. And I thought that plot was fairly conventional. And I was like, okay, we're kind of in a groove here. It's like we kind of have a sense of what this world is. And then the last third, it just exploded. It splintered into a million shards. And I was more lost than I was at the start.
And we'll get there. We will get there. But yeah, it takes a while. You're right. It takes like 20 minutes to get us to like a stasis where it feels like a movie where we're like following multiple plot threads that will presumably like intersect before the end.
Because another thing is that for this first chunk of the movie, like the first 20 or 30 minutes, a lot that happens is really slowed down. You said dreamlike, and there's definitely a lot that feels like you're in a dream. Like things aren't going as fast as they should, is how I felt. Like when she's going down the hill and finding her way into the apartment, and especially there's what might be a dream sequence. There's a guy talking about having a dream and then like finds himself living the dream that he's talking about. Characters that I don't think you see anywhere else in the movie. They just kind of pop in and are having this discussion almost like a Pulp Fiction discussion or something. I don't know. It was weird. This whole thing is weird. That's going to be a recurring statement.
Let's talk about that one scene, the one with the two men talking in the diner. It's an important diner. It's called Winkies. And they have a coffee, and it appears to be a therapist and his client. And you're right, the client's talking about this dream, and the dream is that he's in the diner that they're in. And then he walks outside, and when he gets outside, he sees a strange man behind the dumpster, a frightening man. And the therapist was like, well, let's just go see that that's not real. Let's go do that. And so they go, and it ends up like flowing exactly as he described his nightmare, because he slowly walks back there and boom. And then you see this creepy man pop out from behind the dumpster. And David Lynch isn't really a horror director, but he is influenced by horror, and he does jump scares so damn well. This is like among the most startled I've ever been watching a movie. It was the first time I saw this scene, because the way it's edited, it has like a cadence where you see the dumpster, you see the guy, you see the dumpster, you see the guy. And then after we're on the guy for like, it's normally like 2 seconds on the guy, but then we're out on him for like a quarter of a second. It cuts back to the dumpster, and then there's this strange man or woman.
We don't know. He's a monster. Say he's a monster. Yeah. That's what serves the purpose, is this is the feared thing. And now it is apparently in the real world and is perplexing our sense of reality.
And some people say that this particular scene is kind of like the Rosetta Stone for the understanding what's happening in the movie. And we can maybe deconstruct that as we get to the end as well. But yeah, so that's kind of one, I call it a thread. It's really just one scene with this therapist and the guy who's talking to him.
Yeah, I had actually seen this scene before on its own on YouTube. And I think just like as a little short film, it works great.
Yeah.
I think it's really compelling, but stuck in randomly as it is, we kind of return to it later on, but it is very separate feeling from most of the rest of what's happening.
It is where we are introduced to Winkies, which is an important setting, a couple of other things. So the other big thread that we kind of talked about is this director. So played by Justin Theroux. I know Justin Theroux best from the TV show The Leftovers, which I've talked about, one of my favorite shows ever. And he's this guy making a movie and he's in the process of casting it. And we meet him when he kind of gets ushered into this movie studio office, but it's just shot so weird. You're in like a prison in someone's mind or something like that. This weird space that like doesn't just feel like a normal geometric space with this, all these creepy looking movie executive guys. And they basically try to strong arm him into casting this one specific girl. They keep saying, "This is the girl." That's like the line from this movie is, "This is the girl." And at first he says, "No, I'm not doing it." But before we talk about what happens next, Brian, do you know Justin Theroux? Any thoughts on this little bit with the director here?
I didn't recognize the actor, but I thought he did an excellent job capturing the director look. Like, he looks halfway on the slider between J.J. Abrams and Quentin Tarantino. Like, he's got the messy hair and the, like, pointy chin and the little glasses.
And the trying to look like I'm not trying cool guy look with sunglasses and untucked shirt stuff. Yeah. So I would say maybe the most extraneous scene in the movie, we've kind of talked about these weird threads or these weird bits that don't quite fit together that to me sort of like actually create a picture and a tone, even if they don't quite fit together. But the one thing that doesn't really fit in to me is this one scene where we follow the director and he goes back to his house and his wife is there and she's like in bed with this guy who cleans the pool or something like that. And then he like just doesn't even react. He just grabs her jewelry and takes some paint and pours it on the jewelry. Just like kind of this weird, almost slapsticky scene out of the blue.
But it's really bright pink paint.
Yeah,
I kind of like that, just that they have this intense color. Like, what were they using that pink paint for?
I don't know. We have some pink paint in our house, or at least we did a couple years ago because my daughter painted her room pink. But yeah, so it seems like Justin Theroux is basically going to decline to follow the lead of these weird movie puppet masters trying to get him to cast this one girl. But then he learns that his movie has just been completely shut down and will only be start back up if he goes to meet the cowboy. So it's like, okay, what is the cowboy? So he goes to this parking lot and this light turns on. It's got like a buffalo skull, like kind of one of the classic saloon looks. And sure enough, there's a man in a cowboy hat. He has no eyebrows. And he basically gives explicit instructions in a very condescending way on how Justin Theroux needs to cast this one girl named Camilla Rhodes. And it says, if you see her, as soon as she comes up, you say, "This is the girl." So I need to know, Brian, what are you thinking when you see this cowboy?
I liked this arc. I could understand it because, okay, he's being pressured by the mob. They want a certain actor to be cast. I mean, that's like a third of The Godfather, right? That's the whole horse in the bed, is that they want an actor to get a part. And the executives at the studio are being persnickety, saying, no, we have control over that. And the mob is saying, nope, it's going to be this way, or you'll have a horse head in your bed. So, okay, that's A to B to C. That flows for me. And I liked that he had to go way out into the middle of nowhere to meet this cowboy, because that kind of echoes the slow walk out behind the dumpster with the dream sequence earlier. And it's like heading out into the unknown where stuff is more dangerous and threatening. And in this gangster plot line, they could snuff you out in the desert and nobody would ever know.
I agree. It adds a sense of intimidation to everything that he does. One thing the cowboy says, you will see me one more time if you do good. You will see me two more times if you do bad. Which to me just kind of captures the David Lynchian. It almost sounds right, but it's just vaguely outside of something a human would actually say.
Right. And of course, it makes it all weirder that he has no eyebrows.
Absolutely, yeah.
I shaved off an eyebrow once just to see what that was like. It didn't take too long to grow back, but it makes a big difference not having eyebrows.
Yeah, it shapes your face.
It makes you look sickly.
Mm.
Like you've got cancer or something. I don't know. It's very off-putting.
We do eventually see him in the midst of casting the lead role, and sure enough, Camilla Rhodes walks in and he leans over and he says, this is the girl, like he's supposed to. So the mob's plan ends up working. Although the thing that he's casting, it's like this weird, I don't even know what it's supposed to be, but we just keep seeing these girls. Girl is the word they use. They're women, young women, singing this girl group pop song, including this one song. We get most of it. It's called, I think, 16 Reasons Why or 16 Reasons or something. And it's just a weird bit of 60s girl group pop, very much adding to the flavor that this could be. It's a blend of everything from the 50s to the 90s in a weird, throw it in a blender, pour it out. It's a mid-century slurry. Yeah, so that's kind of what's going on with the director. The third thread, that's again just a couple of scenes, is we follow this bumbling assassin. And it might be the funniest scene in the movie is he's in this office talking to this guy, this guy who we're going to learn is an assassin. He's just chatting, and then all of a sudden he pulls a gun out and shoots the guy. But you would think, okay, he's an assassin, that's what he had to do. But he gets it, he drops the gun or something, and a bullet shoots through a wall, and it hits a woman in this other room, and he goes in the other room, again, very slowly walking out of the room and into the other room, and she says, something bit me bad, or something like that. So now he's trying to get her back into the first room so he can kill her too, because he's trying to get away undetected. And as he's doing this, this third guy is a janitor pops out. And so then he has to kill the janitor too. And then all of a sudden he accidentally hits the something that makes the smoke alarm go off.
And he shoots the vacuum cleaner.
Oh, that's what it is.
The vacuum cleaner explodes, or it short circuits, and then the fire goes up the cord. And so then all the it goes up the cord into the outlet, and then the outlet sparks, and then all the alarms in the whole building go off, which was the perfect punchline, because one makes the sense that he keeps killing people so that there's not going to be witnesses. It's not going to draw attention. It's kill the next person, kill the next person, and finally there's not going to be people noticing me. But then now all the alarms are going off.
Yeah.
So he has failed conclusively.
I forgot that there was the thing with the short-circuiting, and it's in the, what's the movie, the Tom Hanks movie we discussed?
The Money Pit.
Yeah, where the as wires go out, it's going throughout the wall until something explodes. Yeah. Good stuff.
I did laugh at that. I liked that.
And we see this assassin again, and we get the sense that he's actually after the girl that we know as Rita, the woman. And yeah, so those are kind of things that we see that feel like they're all coming to a head. We have this director, this assassin, and then of course we have Betty and Rita. So this is where things start to get haywire. So back to Rita and Betty here for a minute. So they're trying to discover Rita's true identity. Now, so at some point, Rita has this mental flash. My name is Diane Selwyn. And so they look up this name, Diane Selwyn. They call her. Betty says, "It's so strange to be calling yourself," or something like that. Because, of course, Rita is trying to call the number where she thinks it's her own number. And they go, they figure out it's an apartment. They go down to this apartment. But now, just before they actually go there, Betty actually has to go and do this audition. So she goes to a place where they're casting. Now, the first like two times I saw this movie, I thought it was the movie that Justin Theroux was casting, which would make a whole lot of sense. It would like tie the things together. But it's actually not that movie. It's a totally different movie.
Right. It's like one step removed, like at the same studio or across the street. Theroux's working on his movie because Betty does this audition and like she had a family connection to this crew that's making this movie. She says that the guy who is kind of marshalling everything, who might be the director of this project, was like a friend of her father.
Mm-hmm.
And he's played by Frank, the warehouse manager from Return of the Living Dead. So I was like, oh, man, it's that guy.
Yeah, you were excited.
But she blows it out of the park. Dan will talk a little bit more about this audition that she does. But then, like, everybody notices her. And a lady is like, wow, I know somebody you need to meet. And takes her across the street to where Theroux is casting his thing. And that's when Theroux sees Camilla and says, this is the girl.
Yeah, so they do converge, but not in the way that I initially kind of processed it.
Right.
So this audition scene, it's like strikingly very warm and engaging, and they're patient with her. And if you've ever seen a Hollywood story with an actress trying to break in, it's the opposite of it. Because it's always, like, I'm thinking Emma Stone in La La Land. I'm thinking Party Down, I think, has a scene like this. And there's certainly others. I'm trying to remember what they are. But like how impersonal a Hollywood audition is and how little attention you actually have from the executives and how there's so many people there who are just trying to do the same thing you are doing, grinding, trying to get that one big break, and how it's so dispiriting. Because here, like, everybody's patient with her and praising her and encouraging her. And yeah, she like absolutely knocks it out of the park. She's like draws everyone in. They're like leaning forward and gasp when she does the big dramatic moments of it. And I frequently see this scene cited as like the great scene of this movie. I actually don't think it's the most memorable scene of the movie. It's definitely striking. It's like, oh, so Betty is like the real deal. And just the way that it's shot does like kind of draw you in. But yeah, it's an interesting scene. And it's like she's got instant chemistry with this kind of seedy guy who's hitting on her, this older guy and stuff. It's I don't know. But yeah, it's like enough that they're like, oh, you got to go try out for this other movie. So that's where we get this long eye lock between Betty and Justin Theroux's character, the director. Even though they haven't met, it's like, is there some connection there that we're not quite picking up on? So we'll hold that thought there for the end. And now, as I said, it was starting to get weird. Here's where it gets really weird. So Rita and Betty meet back up and they go to that apartment where Diane Selwyn, who is what they believe Rita's name to be, is supposed to live. At first they meet someone. They're like, oh, wait, are you Diane Selwyn? No, her apartment's over here. So they go there and they go into it and they find a dead body lying on the bed. And it's just shot in a very creepy way. It's like very off-putting. And they're like holding their nose from the stench when they walk in. And yeah, extremely disarming. Would you say, Brian?
Yeah, it was creepy. And then around this point, because they've also been trying to figure out what's the deal with this blue key in the bag. And right around the time they find the body, don't they also find a blue box?
We'll get to the blue box. That's not okay. Just yet. It's almost
not yet.
But right. The blue box is important. So now they realize that if she's connected to Diane Selwyn, and Diane Selwyn's dead, and there's all this other, and there's a big bag of money. Clearly she's into some nasty business, whatever Rita's deal is. And so Rita needs to disguise herself, and she basically disguises herself as Betty. She like gets a blonde wig that makes her look like Naomi Watts. And that night they are lying down to go to sleep, and we've kind of seen that they've kind of been drawn to each other. And what do you know? They get into bed together, and we have a rather explicit sex scene that I was not quite prepared for the first time I watched this movie. It's one of a couple of unexpected explicit sex scenes in this film. But I think this is the first one and maybe the most jarring, but it is like a very passionate one too. It's like erotic, you know?
Yeah. These are both very good looking women. And I guess that fact did not escape David Lynch.
And I think we'll talk about why it's relevant, but like definitely intended to be not just lusty, but like sparks between them too, you know? But they wake up in the middle of the night and Rita has another flash of memory. And this time her flash of memory is Club Silencio. We need to go to a place called Club Silencio. And Betty's like, what is Club Silencio? And at this point, the movie is like just creeping further off of like human reasonable behavior at this point. It's like you're just kind of following a whim like you do in a dream. It's very dreamlike. And so they leave the apartment. They go and they get a ride to this place called Club Silencio. It is this like nightclub, but not like a dancing nightclub, like a theater cabaret nightclub. And there's like, I don't know, maybe 40 people in the audience. And they sit down and we get this show at Club Silencio. And it's a bunch of weird acts they're talking about. There is no orchestra. And like kind of in these sort of vague aphorisms almost. And so we see this magician who makes himself disappear. And then we get this woman who comes on and starts singing. And then she collapses on stage as she's singing. It's actually the song Crying by Roy Orbison, but in Spanish. Really lovely. And right around this time, the movie's using like really intense close-ups on all the actors. We get a weird thing of her like shaking in the audience, like having a seizure, like you were talking about, Brian. Like harsh lights, almost like a Suspiria, but in this case, it's like blue light shining everywhere. And very much just a breakdown of like reality going on is like my reading of it. It's like, is the woman singing or is she not singing? Because the music keeps going when she faints. Is someone there? Is he not there? Because he disappears. Why is she shaking? Oh, wait, all of a sudden now Rita reaches into her bag and pulls out the blue box. Well, presumably the thing that the blue key goes into. Why wasn't it there before? Why do we just discover it now? I don't know. They don't say why. They just have the blue box now.
Right. So a couple things about this performance. The narrators, there's like a string of MCs, one main one, but people who come out and they talk. And the gist of what they're saying, you said there's no orchestra. They keep saying that everything is a recording, basically. And so, yeah, the acts are like somebody plays a trombone and then they stop playing the trombone, but you're still hearing trombone music. Or the lady sings and then when she collapses and is rolling around on the stage, that song is still going on. So everything is an illusion and it's all tied into like recorded media. So that to me maybe says movies are an illusion. Movies are just all made up.
Astute. And I think that ties into what we're kind of getting as an overarching feeling from this film, which is that David Lynch is, despite being a great movie maker, kind of jaded by making movies. Like, he's somewhat cynical, like, oh, there's this huge complex of people that make things happen despite artistic merits of people like directors. And there's just lots of, fakeness. It's all fake and artificial, and you're not in reality, even if it feels like a dream in the good sense, like a wish come true. It's also like a nightmare in many ways, a dream in a bad sense, just like things don't make sense and are arbitrary and frightening and nonsensical. And it's just a messed up nonsense world out there, at least to some extent. It's kind of like a, that's just a feeling. It's not necessarily an explicit theme of the film. So they have this blue box now. And they go back to the apartment after the show. and they go to pull out the key. What is going to be in the blue box? Well, Rita pulls it out, and she's like, Betty, I found it. I don't even know if she says that out loud, but you can tell that she's like holding it up, like, let's do it. And she like looks around. Where is Betty? Betty's now disappeared. Who knows what happened here? Then she puts the key in, she turns it, and it opens the top of the blue box. And she lifts it up and she looks in, and almost as like a jump scare, the camera rapidly zooms into the box. And this is the last we see of Rita and Betty. We're an hour and 55 minutes into the film. There's just about a half hour left. That's the last we see of them, at least like in this timeline.
Right. Well, we're through the looking glass now or something.
Like literally, not literally. We're through the blue box, which is the looking glass. So everything from here on out is like just outside of those threads. It's like another new mini movie, but very tellingly echoes a lot of things that happened in the first half of the film. I say halves. It's not really a half. It's like a last half hour, but
it's like everything got scrambled around. It's a little like The Wizard of Oz. What I was especially thinking of is there's an episode of The Twilight Zone where there's a character who's on trial for like a murder or something. It's a capital crime. And his defense is that it's all a dream. This is just a dream. And I've had this dream over and over again. And every time I get sentenced to the electric chair, they throw the switch and I'm just back here again in the courtroom, except everybody who was in the dream previously is now in a different role. Like whoever was the judge is now my lawyer, and the executioner is somebody in the jury, and they're all scrambled around.
It's like a dark remix on what we had just seen previously, the 2 hours that had led up to it. So, for example, we see Naomi Watts, so the same actress who played Betty, the kind of blonde heroine of the first 2 hours of the film. She wakes up in the exact spot and in the exact position that they had seen the dead body in the apartment. Okay, that's kind of weird. And now she's not like bright-eyed and chipper, but she's a drug addict, apparently. And she's got like big bags under her eyes. And she's kind of in a grim and gray and gritty version of the Hollywood life. That's kind of more what you expect to see when you have a Star Is Born type story. It's like, it doesn't go perfectly on the first audition. You have to grind and grind and hope you get your break, you know? And we see lots of stuff that echoes what we had already seen. But it's kind of retelling the same story, but not exactly. I think I had never thought of Wizard of Oz, but I like that. Because things are like ciphers to other things. And it sort of is like the same relationship between entities, but not in the same exact reality. Although here it's like a closer reality because we're in the same buildings and stuff that we have kind of seen.
Right, and it's the same names too, but now they belong to different people.
Right, because now Naomi Watts is Diane Selwyn. And Camilla Rhodes is the actress played by Rita. Not this other actress, but Camilla Rhodes is Laura Herring. And we see that Diane Selwyn, who we now know her as Diane, previously she was Betty, just like there was a passionate sex scene with her and Laura Herring's character, Rita / Camilla, in the first version that we saw of everything. So they're having an affair here in the grittier reality, except here it's like not as passionate. It's like much skeevier. And we get another unexpected R-rated sex scene here. And yeah, so Naomi Watts is trying to get her, or I should say Diane Selwyn is trying to get her big break, but like she's in a small role that's kind of humiliating and has to see the director. By the way, the director is still Justin Theroux, hitting on Laura Herring / Camilla, who we know that she's in love with. And we just kind of get in rapid fire snippets of Diane Selwyn's life being really miserable until she gets invited to this party. And this party, she rides in a limo that's just like the one we saw in the opening scene, except now it's the opposite actress. And it stops just like it stopped in the first time through, except here, instead of getting killed, it's like a lead into a party. And at the party, we see that very clearly the Laura Herring character has moved on from the Naomi Watts character, Diane Selwyn, as it is. And we learn that she's been engaged to the director.
This announcement is really weird, because I don't think he even finishes the sentence. It's a moment where it's like dragged out. He's like, "Hey, everybody, we're..." And I don't think it ever... I don't think the sentence ends.
I guess it's like to infer that they're...
Sure. But I just felt like I was swimming through treacle in a lot of this movie. It's like, just give me some closure!
Makes your skin crawl a little bit. One thing we learn is that Diane Selwyn, the Naomi Watts character, she kind of gives her life story, and she decided to become an actor when she won a jitterbug contest, going all the way back to the very first weird dance scene of the movie. So, whoa, is this the real reality? Because now we're seeing, just like we saw the first jitterbug, now we're learning about this. At the party are a bunch of people from the previous moments, but like they're just passersby here. For example, the cowboy walks in the background. Did you notice him walking in the background of the party, Brian?
I didn't notice that, but I did notice that the person who was Camilla in the original timeline is here somewhere.
Yeah, and gives a kiss to Camilla. And so then we get the last couple scenes. So now it's kind of after that one party where Diane has had her heart broken. Camilla's gotten the role. She's gotten engaged. She's got the dream life. And so we're back in Winky's, the place where there was the frightening dream sequence. And here, Diane has a bag with money in it, and she hands it over to a man. And we know from the first 2 hours, we've seen this man as the bumbling assassin. And what does Diane say when she hands over a picture of Camilla to this assassin? She says, "This is the girl," which is the line that was like the big repeated line in the first segment. And it's not clear exactly what's going on here, but Diane is hiring this man to do something. And "This is the girl" is Laura Herring's character, Camilla, as we know her during this last half hour or so. And the hitman guy, or whatever he is in this, we don't quite know explicitly, gives a blue key to Naomi Watts, to Diane, and says, "When it's done, you'll see this blue key." And at the very end of the movie, a couple things happen. So one is we get another glimpse of the monster behind Winky's.
And the monster has the box, which, if it had ended there, I would be overall positive on this movie. I think that would be a good wrap up, because it's like, okay, we've got all these disparate threads. We have some connections. We saw the assassin show up at the end. And like my head canon, as best as I can form one, is like maybe the first half of the movie was like a dream that the characters in the second half are having, or vice versa. And kind of this dream monster ties it all together and is like a wow send off. But that's not the very end of the movie.
No, because we have about 3 minutes left. And so it zooms in on the ground where the blue box is. And these little dots start coming out. What are these little dots? I don't know. I can't tell. They get bigger and bigger. Oh, my God. Hold on. Are they people?
It's the old people.
It's old people.
Squawking like parrots and jabbering around and having seizures and going... Rah, 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 rah. And I was ready to pop the DVD out. I was like, no. I'm not on board. He's just rubbing my nose in it.
Too much for you?
Yes.
Then cut back to Diane's apartment. She sees the blue key. She looks at the door and she doesn't even open the door. From the cracks under the door, the old people like shrink. Like in what's the thing that we've referenced a few times? Something Mac, Alex Mac.
Right. Yes, it was like Alex Mac because they went under a door.
Although they don't melt, they just kind of shrink down. But then they come out and they get big again and they like get in her face. And it's like it is exceptionally indescribably creepy when they're coming after her. It's like not something you would normally associate with a horror movie, but it is one of the scarier things you'll see. Very unsettling. And they like chase her down and we get like zoom ins on her. And zoom ins on these old people, like in this expressionistic lighting, and she runs into her bedroom and shoots herself. And that's how the movie ends. She lies down on the red pillow one more time, except this time, smoke filling the room after the gunshot.
But then we see somebody in the club say silencio as the very, very last beat.
Oh, good point. There is one final send off. I had almost forgotten about that. I think it's the singer. It's someone from the club and just says, silencio. And some closing shots of Betty and Rita, or perhaps it's Diane and Camilla, in like a sort of blurry nighttime shot of Hollywood, kind of mirroring the opening with the jitterbug, but not exactly the same, but kind of comes full circle. So, silencio. There we have it, Mulholland Drive, Brian. In case it wasn't clear, it's not obvious how all of these things tie together in this film. It's not explicit. It's not like a twist ending like in The Usual Suspects, when blank is obvious at the end of The Usual Suspects. And it's not like Memento, when in Memento, oh, once you see the last couple scenes, everything that you'd seen beforehand pieces together. Oh, okay, that's what was going on this whole time. Oh, that's why he thought this about this. This movie is sort of that. It's like 40% that, but it's also not that at all.
Right. Yeah, I read some interview with one of the actors, and he said that if anybody during the production expressed the thought that they understood what was going on, David Lynch would, like, assure them that they were wrong. That, to me, is not necessarily a strength. Like, I would hope that somebody involved knows what's going on.
So there is a conventional reading of this film, which I think is well supported. It isn't my exact reading, but I think there is a lot of evidence. And that is the first 2 hours, basically everything from the initial shot on the red pillow up until things do the switch with about a half hour left, is a dream inside the mind of Diane Selwyn. And the last half hour is the quote unquote reality. And the dream that we're seeing is sometime after she's made the contract with the hitman. And by the way, that's part of the conventional reading that in fact, it is a hitman that Naomi Watts, that Diane Selwyn has hired. And the thing that she's hired him to do is to kill Camilla out of a jealous revenge, because now she's got the role, she got the marriage, she left her behind. And so then she goes in sort of like a drug-addled stupor, lies down, falls asleep, has this nightmare that kind of reflects and refracts what's going on in her life and her all of her failures and her guilt about having hired someone to kill the woman that she's in love with still. And then she wakes up and has a psychotic vision of old people coming into her house and kills herself. That's like the conventional reading from people who have seen this movie like 5 times. And there are a whole lot of things that support that. Before I kind of go on, do you at least kind of follow? I mean, it seems like that was kind of where you had landed too, Brian, something like that.
Right. I think that's along the lines of what I said a moment ago. That was kind of how I put it together.
Yeah. Kind of the big evidence behind this, one is that the first half of the movie, the first 2 hours, kind of go out of their way to show Hollywood as being not merit-based, but controlled by the whims of a powerful, shady few, so that even the most talented people, like Diane, as she sees herself in her dream as Betty, as being this preternaturally talented and special actress who gets all the special treatment in the auditions and just blows them away with her natural talent, that despite her being that, that's why she's not getting the roles. It's because these people are pulling these strings, and it's not because she's a failure in any way, but because of this, it's like a subconscious justification. It's not my fault that I haven't made it big in Hollywood. And similarly, we see kind of this sort of dream of a perfect existence with Rita, or Camilla as she is in the quote unquote real world. Rita being so dependent upon her and deeply in love with her. In fact, so much she wants to transform herself into a clone of her. Lots of like dualities and like merging and unmerging identities, both across the two realities, like the dream sequence that makes the first 2 hours and the quote unquote reality that makes the half hour afterwards. And the biggest piece of evidence is basically like that 2 hour sequence starts with a zoom in on a pillow, and it ends with, I don't think we said this, but like a man, it's actually the cowboy saying, "Wake up, little girl," or something along those lines. So like, well, yeah, you've basically in the text of the film frame this as a dream. You have a zoom in on a pillow, and then you have a man appearing saying, "Wake up, little girl," and then a switch to a different reality. So there's like a whole, there's essays and essays online of like all the little psychological things, and oh, this connects to this. If you like look at this from this way, there's a lot of evidence that that's basically the vision that David Lynch has piecing this together. So, but that's not quite how I read it. I think there's a lot of evidence to that, and I think it kind of makes sense. But the thing I don't like is I don't like calling one the dream fake and one the reality. To me, that doesn't quite jibe, because there's so much weird stuff in the reality, too, that it's not like everything's fantastical and then everything's gritty reality. There's lots of, like, the whole old people thing is in the quote-unquote reality. There's other weird stuff that happens in the reality. The segment that often is attributed as the after she wakes up and is in real life. In some ways, it's even more dreamlike than the first half. So, like, my slight variation on it is the first 2 hours and then the last half hour are mirrors of two different versions of how you can look at Hollywood. It is a factory of dreams, but it's also a factory of nightmares where people go and get ground down. And those things live in a kind of dark equilibrium with each other. Like, they're both aspects of Hollywood. Neither is the complete picture of Hollywood, but they kind of feed each other. And to me, I almost see as like the two gateways between the two realities. You have like the red and the blue, the red pillow and the blue box, that are kind of like the two bookends to each like version of reality. So, I mean, if you want to just say the first half is a dream sequence and the second half isn't, I think there's more than enough textual evidence to support that. But I think it's more just like David Lynch's thesis on the two versions of Hollywood, how they're both toxic in different ways, and just kind of like the dual nature of show business. You need fake, but you need like authenticity. You need stars, but you need people to be ground up and fail. You need prettiness, but you need ugliness, like the grimy guy who lives behind the monster, who lives behind the dumpster.
You got to have a goblin. It's not life if you don't have a goblin.
And to me, those thematic things just really tie in together. And yeah, I mean, it definitely ends on a very bleak note after having like, there's always a sense of dread, but there's like, it's lighter in those first 2 hours, more or less. And then it's just very dark the last half hour. So it does kind of end on some grimness, but that's my take on it.
You know, it's a little like the end of La La Land, where you're glimpsing the two paths. In that case, honestly, as we said, both of the paths pretty positive. No goblins in La La Land. No screaming old people.
Well, there is a goblin in Damien Chazelle's next movie, Babylon. That's Tobey Maguire.
That's true. He realized what was missing.
Yeah.
My next Hollywood movie, gotta have a goblin.
You gotta have a goblin. Rule number one. So, Brian, a couple weeks ago, we talked about 8.5. And one thing that I said is, oh, David Lynch obviously loves 8.5. Did you get that impression at all as you were watching Mulholland Drive? Did you see much 8.5 in Mulholland Drive?
I guess what I see is it has the slipping and lunging into fantasy.
Definitely.
Like, it's never quite fully moored in reality. He's always got his head in the clouds. Also, you know, there's some of casting a woman. Like, that's a central thread, is who is going to play this female part in the movie, and there's a whole bunch of women, like, competing for that. And different people have vested interests in who gets the part.
And more than that, the casting is kind of like a metaphor for life and, like, this director's relationship with real life and, like, the fates of the women, basically, to some extent.
Right. So it didn't jump out to me as I watched. I mean, I've been watching so many movies about making movies, it kind of blurs. But I can definitely see what you're talking about now.
And it stars a director as a main character. But again, that's a movie about making movie. But, like, how he kind of filters his reality through the making of this movie. Yeah. I don't know. There's definitely a lot there. And I think if you ever go watch 8.5 again, you'll be like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's Mulholland Drive right there. Yeah. Lots of tracking shots. And I don't know why, but they're just so creepy. And, like, something about, like, when he just walks through a room with a camera. I think it's probably Steadicam. It doesn't feel always handheld. Sometimes it does. But, like, you'll just, like, go through a hallway and turn left and then turn right and go through a door, like, first person style. Just kind of unsettling. But yeah, what were some things I said we would point out? So we talked about the red pillow. Oh, the cowboy. You do see him two more times. So it's, you will see me two more times if you do bad. So we see him once when he's the one who tells Betty / Diane to wake up. And we also see him at the party in the quote unquote gritty reality when he's walking in the background. So we actually do see him twice. So I guess Diane Selwyn did bad. That's actually a piece of evidence that people cite, is like, that's how Diane Selwyn knew that she did bad, that she was feeling guilty because she saw the cowboy and she imagined the cowboy. So she saw him twice after that. So,
oh, interesting. Also, the little dude from Twin Peaks shows up in this movie. He's like the head of the gangsters pressuring the director.
Yes, and also in, like, a weird shaped and colored room. In Twin Peaks, one of the most famous scenes of Twin Peaks, I think they just call it the Red Room. And is it a dream sequence, I think? And it's, like, words are half mumbled, and then there's, like, a goofy dance. Is it the little guy that does the goofy dance?
It is. And so he speaks backwards. Well, he says messages, but it's they're pronounced phonetically backwards, so that then you play the footage in reverse and you can kind of hear it in English. And I recreated that scene for Gauntlet just to flex.
Very nice.
So I will drop that in the Discord.
Any other good things, not so good things, things you want to shout out?
Just one more thing I'll compare the kind of bifurcated structure of this film to. It's kind of like when they went from the Zelda game Ocarina of Time and then released Majora's Mask, because they had a quick turnaround time to do it. It's like only 2 years between the games. And so they took all the assets that they made for the first game and they, like, scrambled them around. And so the people that you knew in the first game, now they're all different people. And, like, the towns are scrambled and just everything is that combination of familiar but different than what you knew.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. Even in this notion of, like, dual realities with, like, especially one darker than the other, we see in Elephant Man, because we see the rich people there, but then we also see, like, especially when the Elephant Man gets discovered and it's like a creepy underground circus. And that's, I don't know, kind of like the flip side of it. Yeah. Oh, I feel like I could talk about Mulholland Drive forever. I actually have only seen, well, I've seen Twin Peaks, so that's kind of one of the core David Lynch works. I've only seen the first two seasons, and I don't even think I finished the second season. It gets a little bit sloggy in the second season of Twin Peaks because David Lynch kind of got fired or quasi-fired, and they had to fill in a bunch of space and they didn't know what to do. And so some of the plots get drawn out and some of the plots get weird. Not that David Lynch was ever not weird, but, you know, weird in a different way. Just like, what the hell are they thinking weird?
So something I didn't say yet is with Twin Peaks, I've had so many people recommend Twin Peaks to me over my life. Like, you, Brian, specifically will like Twin Peaks. So I felt pressured that I have to like it, that I should like it. And I watched it. Well, I only watched the first few episodes because, like, that iconic dream sequence is in, like, the second or third episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very weird. I don't know. Maybe I need to go back to it. Dan, I would recommend that you watch Eraserhead.
Yeah, I should.
I felt like Eraserhead had a lot in common with Elephant Man. We talked about that at the time.
Yeah. He also made Dune, which, like, an early version of Dune, which now obviously is a Denis Villeneuve, or however you say his name, franchise. I really want to see Twin Peaks Season 3, which some people say is his grand masterwork. It's called Twin Peaks The Return, 13 episodes. I want to see Inland Empire too. People say it's just like David Lynchisms on crack, basically. So, and he shot that one on digital. Mulholland Drive was his second last movie, but the last one he shot on film. And then he went digital and leaned into the weird digital effects, apparently, in Inland Empire. So maybe I'll give us a few months break, Brian, but at some point I'm going to bring on Inland Empire.
What if David Lynch collaborated with Robert Rodriguez?
Oh, man.
You're talking digital effects.
Yeah. If you could see David Lynch adapt one fictional property, one franchise, what would it be?
Oh, yeah. I think if he did a Spy Kids.
Oh, you want to see him do a Spy Kids? Yeah. Oh, that could be great. Get real Freudian with it, maybe.
I don't even know what it would be. I'm a little on the fence about David Lynch.
Well, maybe that's a good transition. You can opine on that a bit further, Brian. So we've reached our signature section, and that is it good? So in Is It Good, we each give the movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, which is a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. Brian, I'm clenching my seat. I'm actually not sitting, but if I were sitting, I would be clenching my seat right now. Just on edge of the seat anticipation. Is Mulholland Drive good?
I guess we've talked about it before. You stand like you're recording an album or something, like you're doing a operetta when you record the podcast.
It's a full body experience to Beyond the Goods, a film podcast, Brian.
You got
to
hear all the overtones and undertones of the diaphragm. Hopefully that's coming across on our microphones. We do have pretty good microphones. So where it falls for me, I was sweating it a little bit over the week. Because where did it land on your top 100 list, Dan?
High, and I'll get to that in a second.
And it's on the Sight and Sounds, like super high, clearly very well regarded. But maybe this is like a you got to eat your vegetables type thing. Like the real good stuff, what's going to make you big and strong if you eat it, that's this corpus of films. It's, you know, you got to challenge yourself sometimes. This is a really frustrating movie to me. And I do appreciate that we've talked through it because it's gelling for me a little more now, and I'm more comfortable in this rating that I'm going to give it, which is a 4 out of 8. Good-ish. Like, there are elements of it that I quite liked, like the bumbling assassin made me laugh, and the jitterbug effects at the start were really cool, and the middle chunk of it where it's about the like corrupt gangsters pressuring the director, and it's a narrative that flows. It's like, okay, I'm following it. I wasn't before and I won't be again. And then when they went through the looking glass and there were the alternate versions of them, it's like, okay, well, this is kind of a new paradigm. They're doing something different, but I maybe kind of get this. And then when it was all sealed together by the reappearance of the dream demon, like, all right, this is weird, this is pretentious, but it has maybe gelled again as like a coherent thing. And then those squawking old people are jabbering around. And I really think that Lynch is high on his own supply or something. He's like, he's so far off the beaten path. He knows nobody's going to tell him no. So he can just have random tiny old people yelling. I don't know if I've talked about it before. I probably have, because the infuriating memory lives deep inside me. But I went to an art museum once and saw an exhibit on Dada. Have I talked about this?
I don't think so.
Okay. So Dada is like surrealism plus. It's like aggressively avoiding meaning. At least that's my understanding of it.
Okay.
But they had this big installation of a bunch of orchestra instruments wired together. And it said there was going to be a performance at like 2:30. And this was a field trip where we had to go to the museum and like write, you know, X many facts about X many exhibits at one museum. And then with time left in the day, you could go to the food court. You could get gelato, or you could go and look at the dinosaurs at the Natural History Museum or something. But I saw this sign and I thought, well, maybe this will be worthwhile. I'll stick around and listen to this, what I assumed was like a one-man band, like a mechanical one-man band, player piano type thing. All the instruments were going to play at 2:30 if I just sat there and I waited. So I sat there and I waited, and finally 2:30 rolled around and it was just noise. It was a siren blaring and just things banging and not tuneful. And it's not quite the same thing here. There's more craft here, I feel. I think David Lynch obviously knows how to direct a movie. And what's more is he's a master of tone. Like, he's very much establishes a vibe here. And it is dreamlike, and maybe that's the point. But if nobody on set can tell you what's going on, that to me is a shortcoming. So that's where I fall right at the moment.
So this is a bunch of Dada noise to you. That's what Mulholland Drive is.
A lot of it is. Not completely. I was almost going to give it a 3, but then I was able to form a theory by the end of our discussion here, which it sounds like is the common theory. So maybe I didn't miss as much as I thought.
So I think that this film is a masterpiece. It's going to get an 8, a tour de good from me. Our biggest gap in a while. I don't think too much of what you said is like factually inaccurate. Like, I think it is kind of true that it's intentionally obtuse. Like, there's no one way that everything in this movie makes sense. Even if you want to like pull in like your whole extra, what do you call it? Like, theory, like that's outside of the text, headcanon, I guess. If you want to like try to piece it all together and think of it as a mystery where you gotta be Sherlock Holmes and like pull your detective glass and say, oh, that's the same room where that happened. And that actor played that person and that person. So that must mean that this person is this. I think if you get too far in that, you kind of lose what's great about Mulholland Drive to me, which is kind of like what you said. It's a vibe, but it's a vibe with like just kind of a gnarly sort of noir detective story that kind of twists in on itself and like uses images that defy expectations and like brings them in on itself. But it's also, you're just kind of there for the ride. And like the way that the story like starts to assemble and then disassembles is just like, it's almost an extra sensory experience. It's like I don't know. I like, normally I don't like things that are too obtuse, which maybe that's not true because I guess I do like a lot of things that are obtuse. But like, I find it pleasing the way that it makes me feel unsettled, the way that the story doesn't quite piece together and then it turns upside down and it's something totally different and takes you for a total head spinning ride somewhere else. I'm being very vague here, but I just think it's a bleak impressionistic masterpiece. And I think you can get out of it what you want to take out of it. It's like so full of ideas and potential threads that connect together, but also just like weird vignettes that form a mood that kind of overwhelms you. it's a little bit honestly reminded me of kind of how we talked about As I Was Moving Ahead. Occasionally I saw Brief Glimpses of Beauty or whatever that movie's called, where I was really feeling the vibe and you were very much not feeling the vibe.
Very much not feeling that vibe.
And in defense of the old people, if you really want to like try to apply, what is it when you have like each thing means something, it's like a specific kind of allegory. I don't know. There's like a name for that kind of allegory. If you really want to like project meaning on the old people, they kind of somewhat abstractly, somewhat vaguely represent like kind of the crush of like what the culture has kind of built up stardom to be, built up glamorous life to be. And they're like the consumers, like the everyday people who expect Hollywood to be the certain thing and have kind of built Hollywood up to be the certain thing. But then this kind of like Americana, this modernist dream of being a star and going and making it in talent, it's false. It's built on ugliness, and it comes and eventually crushes you and destroys you if you let it.
It'll Alex Mack under your door.
Exactly. Something like that. So yeah, I think this is a great movie. I had it at number 8 on my top 100, and I would not really move it up or down on this most recent viewing. I still think it's a masterpiece, and I still think it's one of my favorites. And it makes me excited to see more David Lynch movies. I, at one point, was thinking like, oh man, this is my chance to binge David Lynch. But then I was like, I don't want to binge David Lynch. I want to space it out. So maybe I'll pick one David Lynch movie to watch and savor. Maybe Wild at Heart. I don't know. Maybe I'll finally watch Eraserhead. I like watching directors in chronological order. So maybe I should go back to the start. I think he's one of the great image and tone makers, and does really interesting things with stories, even if he's not like what you would think of as a narrative craftsman in the traditional sense, because he doesn't build, like, to your point, he is kind of high on his own supply of like being weird for the sake of weird. And that's just how he tells a story. He has an idea for a thing he wants to be in his movie. He puts the damn weird old people in the movie. He puts the blue box and blue key. He puts the goblin behind the dumpster. And yeah, he does that stuff, but he still always makes it feel whole for me. So at least in the ones that I've seen. So Mulholland Drive gets an 8 for me, Brian. And that is my last pick of movies about making movies month. And I would encourage listeners, if you have your own theories and opinions on Mulholland Drive, come tell us why I'm wrong for being so high on it. Come tell us why Brian's wrong for being so cynical about it. He did still give it a 4, which is a nearly positive rating. I won't be too hard on him about it. But I think it is valid to not like this kind of movie. I really do. It's an astringent, strong flavor. So like, you might like it or you might not like it. And I think that's okay.
It can be hard to rate really, really weird movies.
I completely agree. I've struggled with that in the past.
Like, we had a disparity on things like House previously.
Yeah, for similar reasons, yeah. Listeners, if you want to tell us what we got right or what we got wrong, come to our Discord where you can chat with us. We're fairly active there on thegoodsfilmpodcast.com. I look forward to hearing from you. But as we wrap up Movies About Making Movies Month, Brian, what is our final selection? How are we saying goodbye to this wonderful and extended month that we have enjoyed together?
Yes, one final chapter in our sprawling month. And part of the time, I think we'll talk about other stuff that we could have watched, because the list just goes on and on and on. But it is good to have an ending point. And so what I am going to have us watch is 2 movies again. One movie and a movie about how that movie was made. And it's kind of in line with Ed Wood, my last pick, because I want us to watch The Room from 2003 by the enigmatic independent director Tommy Wiseau, and then James Franco's tribute to it called The Disaster Artist.
The Room, one of the titans of bad cinema, at least in the 21st century. Maybe not quite as much a titan as Plan 9 from Outer Space, but the heir apparent to it.
Exactly. It's a new generation. And James Franco stars as Tommy Wiseau. and his brother plays the put upon actor who is hanging out with Tommy.
It's soccer, Greg. It's soccer. That's who Dave Franco plays in Superbad. The guy who plays soccer and pees his pants.
There's just so many cameos in The Disaster Artist. It's just everybody's a famous face. Everybody wanted to be in there somewhere.
Well, I've never seen The Room and I've never seen The Disaster Artist, so I am quite excited for this. The Room has been hyped up a lot, Brian, as a bad movie, but a special bad movie. So we'll see if that holds up.
Right. And we'll talk about, yeah, my history with the film. It was definitely hyped even before I saw it, which was back like when the wave was cresting in like 2010. But we'll get into that next time.
All right. Listeners, thank you for joining us on our ride down Mulholland Drive. And Brian, thank you for joining me, for indulging me, for talking through one of my favorite films. This was fun.
Oh, you're welcome, Dan. It was fun. I hope you had fun too, listeners. And then you'll join us next time.